Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Mind's Eye Radio. My name is Trevor, and I will be reading articles of politics, opinion, finance, business, science, and art from The Economist, from the 36th week of 2023. Cover story: How Artificial Intelligence Will Affect the Elections of 2024. Disinformation will become easier to produce, but it matters less than you might think. Politics is supposed to be about persuasion, but it has always been stalked by propaganda. Campaigners dissemble, exaggerate, and fib. They transmit lies, ranging from bald-faced to white, through whatever means are available. Anti-vaccine conspiracies were once propagated through pamphlets instead of podcasts. A century before COVID-19, anti-maskers in the era of Spanish flu waged a disinformation campaign. They sent fake messages from the Surgeon General via Telegram, the wires, not the smartphone app. Because people are not angels, elections have never been free from falsehoods and mistaken beliefs. But as the world contemplates a series of votes in 2024, something new is causing a lot of worry. In the past, disinformation has always been created by humans. Advances in generative artificial intelligence, with models that can spit out sophisticated essays and create realistic images from text prompts, make synthetic propaganda possible. The fear is that disinformation campaigns may be supercharged in 2024, just as countries with a collective population of some 4 billion, including America, Britain, India, Indonesia, Mexico, and Taiwan, prepare to vote. How worried should their citizens be? It is important to be precise about what generative AI tools like ChatGPT do and do not change. Before they came along, disinformation was already a problem in democracies. The corrosive idea that America's presidential election in 2020 was rigged brought rioters to the Capitol on January 6th, but it was spread by Donald Trump, Republican elites, and conservative mass media outlets using conventional means. Activists for the BJP in India spread rumors via WhatsApp threads. Propagandists for the Chinese Communist Party transmit talking points to Taiwan through seemingly legitimate news outfits. All of this is done without using generative AI tools. What could large language models change in 2024? One thing is the quantity of disinformation. If the volume of nonsense were multiplied by 1,000 or 100,000, it might persuade people to vote differently. A second concerns quality. Hyper-realistic deepfakes could sway voters before false audio, photos, and videos could be debunked. A third is micro-targeting. With AI, voters may be inundated with highly personalized propaganda at scale. Networks of propaganda bots could be made harder to detect than existing disinformation efforts are. Voters' trust in their fellow citizens, which in America has been declining for decades, may well suffer as people began to doubt everything. This is worrying, but there are reasons to believe AI is not about to wreck humanity's 2,500-year-old experiment with democracy. Many people think that others are more gullible than they themselves are. In fact, voters are hard to persuade, especially on salient political issues such as whom they want to be president. Ask yourself what deepfake could change your choice between Joe Biden and Mr. Trump. The multi-billion-dollar campaign industry in America that uses humans to persuade voters can generate only minute changes in their behavior. Tools to produce believable fake images and text have existed for decades. Although generative AI might be a labor-saving technology for internet troll farms, it is not clear that effort was the binding constraint in the production of disinformation. New image generation algorithms are impressive, but without tuning and human judgment, they are still prone to produce pictures of people with six fingers on each hand, making the possibility of personalized deepfakes remote for the time being. Even if these AI-augmented tactics were to prove effective, they would soon be adopted by many interested parties. The cumulative effect of these influence operations would be to make social networks even more cacophonous and unusable. It is hard to prove that mistrust translates into a systematic advantage for one party over the other. Social media platforms, where misinformation spreads, and AI firms say they are focused on the risks. OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, says it will monitor usage to try to detect political influence operations. Big tech platforms, criticized both for propagating disinformation in the 2016 election and taking down too much in 2020, have become better at identifying suspicious accounts, though they have become loath to arbitrate the truthfulness of content generated by real people. Alphabet and Meta ban the use of manipulated media in political advertising and say they are quick to respond to deepfakes. Other companies are trying to craft a technological standard establishing the provenance of real images and videos. Voluntary regulation has limits, however, and the involuntary sort poses risks. Open source models like Meta's Llama, which generates text, and Stable Diffusion, which makes images, can be used without oversight. And not all platforms are created equal. TikTok, the video-sharing social media company, has ties to China's government, and the app is designed to promote virality from any source, including new accounts. Twitter, which is now called X, cut its oversight team after it was bought by Elon Musk, and the platform is a haven for bots. The agency regulating elections in America is considering a disclosure requirement for campaigns using synthetically generated images. This is sensible, though malicious actors will not comply with it. Some in America are calling for a Chinese-style system of extreme regulation. There, AI algorithms must be registered with a government body and somehow embody core socialist values. Such heavy-handed control would erode the advantage America has in AI innovation. Technological determinism, which pins all the foibles of people on the tools they use, is tempting, but it is also wrong. Although it is important to be mindful of the potential of generative AI to disrupt democracies, panic is unwarranted. Before the technological advances of the past 2 years, people were quite capable of transmitting all manner of destructive and terrible ideas to one another. The American presidential campaign of 2024 will be marred by disinformation about the rule of law and the integrity of elections. But its progenitor will not be something newfangled like ChatGPT. It will be Mr. Trump. Section 1. America's plan to cut drug prices comes with unpleasant side effects. It is already changing how pharma companies make drugs. America is the piggy bank of the pharma world, gripes David Mitchell of Patients for Affordable Drugs, a consumer lobbying group. There is some truth to this. America is the world's largest pharmaceutical market, with $630 billion in sales in 2022, or 42% of the worldwide total. Its contribution to profits, 65% of the global haul, is greater still. American patients have long borne the burden of these juicy returns. Prescription medicines in America cost 2 to 3 times more on average than in other wealthy countries. Patients' out-of-pocket expenses, the slice of drug costs not covered by insurance, are also among the highest in the world. One reason for high prices is that, unlike other countries, America has not regulated drug prices. Until recently, it was illegal for Medicare, the government-funded health insurance for over 65s, to haggle with drug companies. That is set to change. The Inflation Reduction Act, or the IRA, passed last August, gives Medicare the power to negotiate directly with pharmaceutical firms. It also forces companies to pay a rebate to Medicare if their drug prices rise faster than inflation. The Congressional Budget Office, a federal agency, estimates that price capping measures will lop $96 billion from the federal deficit by 2031. On August 29th, the government named the first 10 drugs chosen for price negotiation, which will take effect in 2026. Pharma firms have little choice but to agree to the price set by officials. Any that walk away will have to choose between paying stringent fines or withdrawing all of their drugs from the Medicare program. The backlash from the pharma industry has been fierce. "This is not negotiation. It is tantamount to extortion," protested Merck, an American drug maker, in a lawsuit against the government. A slew of pharma giants, Astellas, Boehringer Ingelheim, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Johnson & Johnson, have joined the legal bandwagon, challenging price-setting provisions in the IRA. Pharma bosses are bracing for price cuts of between 25 and 95% in drugs chosen for price negotiation. Since the law's passage, over 50 companies have blamed the IRA in earnings calls for clouding their prospects. It is already having some unwanted side effects. One issue is a provision in the law that could change the types of drugs that these companies develop. Most medicines are either small molecule drugs or large molecule drugs. The former are chemical-based pills of the kind that line medicine cabinets. Large molecule drugs, also called biologics, are more complex and must be injected into the bloodstream. The IRA grants biologics 13 years of pricing freedom after the drug is approved, whereas small molecule drugs get only 9 years post-approval before they face Medicare's bean counters. Jonathan Khoury of LEK, a consultancy, estimates that small molecule brands could lose between 25 and 40% in overall revenue due to early price caps. Executives fret that the new rules will dissuade innovation in small molecule pills. Last November, Eli Lilly, a big American drug maker, binned a small molecule cancer drug from its pipeline, blaming the IRA for making the investment unviable. In the same month, Alkermes, a British biotech firm, announced plans to spin off its biologics-focused oncology business into an independent company. Richard Pops, the company's chief executive, explained that the IRA had made biologic medicines more valuable. Another contentious provision in the law starts the pricing clock at the drug's launch. Pharma firms usually introduce a new drug to small patient populations, like those with rare conditions or late-stage diseases, who have few alternatives, before widening availability to others. With only 9 years in which to maximize returns, companies will try to delay the clock by launching their drug for the largest disease areas, believes David Fredrickson, who leads the oncology division of AstraZeneca, an Anglo-Swedish pharma giant. Genentech, an American biotech firm owned by Roche, a Swiss drug maker, is considering postponing the launch of its upcoming small molecule drug for ovarian cancer. Instead, the company may wait a few years until the drug has been cleared for use in the much larger prostate cancer market. The impact of the IRA may be muted, at least until the end of this decade. J.P. Morgan Chase, a bank, suggests that the new law's price cuts will be only a modest drag on Big Pharma's growth in its first few years. But as more medicines are added, drug makers will feel more pain. And if the new rules dissuade pharma firms from developing small molecule drugs, they could prove counterproductive by raising prices in the long term. Unlike biologics, which are harder to copy, small molecule pills are flooded with cheaper knockoffs once their patent expires. Alexis Borisy, a biotech investor, notes that uncertainty around the returns for small molecule medicines is already influencing funding decisions. That is a big problem. Big Pharma relies on smaller, more agile biotech firms for ideas. Between 2015 and 2021, 65% of the 138 new drugs launched by Big Pharma originated in external partnerships, mostly with smaller firms. Given America's disproportionate role in the discovery of new therapies, disruptions to the innovation pipeline could have far-reaching consequences. Section 2. How can American house prices still be rising? Mortgage payments are at their highest since the mid-1980s. Home ownership regularly nears the top of surveys about what Americans want most in life. Alas, this part of the American dream has rarely been harder to attain. Those looking to enter the property market face a triple whammy of high prices, costly mortgages, and limited choice. Together, these factors have conspired to make housing deeply unaffordable, with little sign of relief on the horizon. Yet, in a roundabout way, the property crunch also helps explain one of the most pressing economic conundrums of the day, why American growth has remained robust, defying predictions of a recession. Although housing is usually among the sectors most sensitive to interest rates, things have not been quite so straightforward in America. As the Federal Reserve turned hawkish over the past 2 years, mortgage rates soared, ascending from less than 3% to more than 7%. For the median family buying the median home, mortgage payments doubled from roughly 14% of monthly household income in 2020 to nearly 29% in June, the highest since 1985, according to the National Association of Realtors. Surprisingly, the jump in mortgage rates has not led to a decline in house prices. They fell briefly as rates began to rise, but have since rebounded to the record highs hit early last year after COVID-era stimulus washed across the economy. Figures released on August 29th showed that this rebound may be gaining strength. House prices in the second quarter of the year rose at an annualized pace of 15%, according to the S&P Chase Chiller Index, a benchmark for American property prices. What explains this impressive resilience? For something the size of America's property market, where annual sales are worth around $2 trillion, scattered across the continent-sized economy in which some regions are flourishing and others are contracting, there is inevitably a nuanced answer. However, a good summary came in late August from Douglas Yearley, chief executive of Toll Brothers, one of America's biggest home builders, during an earnings call. "There are still buyers out there. They have very few options," he explained. Although demand for homes has fallen as rates have risen, the supply of properties has fallen almost in lockstep. Home buyers typically obtain fixed-rate mortgages for 30 years, unheard of in most countries, but viewed almost as a constitutional right in America, owing to the role of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two giant government-backed firms which buy up mortgages from lenders and securitize them. In enabling lenders to offer long-term fixed rates, their objective is to make it easier for people to buy homes. But now, long-term rates are serving as an impediment, since homeowners who got low-interest mortgages before the Fed raised rates have no desire to give them up, and so are unwilling to sell their homes. Redfin, a property platform, calculates that 82% of homeowners have mortgage rates below 5%. Charlie Doherty of Wells Fargo, a bank, calls the result a state of suspended animation for the housing market. The decline in transactions, all else being equal, ought to hurt the economy, dampening housing-related activity with less money spent on remodeling, new construction, furniture, and so on. This is not how things have played out, however. Unable to trade up to nicer digs, locked-in homeowners have invested more in fixing up their current homes. The rise of remote working has reinforced this trend, with people adding extra office space to their houses. Remodeling expenditures in 2022 reached nearly $570 billion, or about 2% of GDP, up by 40% in nominal terms from 2019, according to the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Many of those braving the market in order to purchase homes have opted for new builds rather than existing stock. One advantage of newly built homes is that they are actually available. This means that they account for about one-third of active listings this year, up from an average of 13% over the 2 decades before the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the National Association of Home Builders. As Daryl Fairweather of Redfin puts it, builders are benefiting because they don't have competition from existing homeowners. Home builders have also been bold in offering incentives to buyers. Most strikingly, they have been buying down as much as 1.5 percentage points on mortgage rates by paying a one-time fee up front that reduces future interest payments. This has allowed their in-house mortgage companies to offer rates of roughly 5%. For home builders, these buy-downs are equivalent to knocking off about 6% from their selling price, which they can easily afford given the strength of their balance sheets. For buyers, the lower mortgage rates are welcome relief in the current environment, which is translated into a pickup in both purchases and construction. New starts on single-family homes bottomed out late last year. In July, starts were up by nearly 10% compared with a year earlier. Property types now wonder whether the price resilience will continue. The market faces a test as mortgage rates climb even higher. For much of the past year, rates had seemed to stabilize at around 6.5%, but since the start of August, investors have concluded that the Fed will keep policy tight for longer, which has pushed mortgages towards 7.5%. The higher rates go, the more demand falls. This is going to catch up with the home builders pretty quickly, reckons John Burns, a property consultant. To counter a slowdown, some lenders may offer riskier deals. Zillow, a property platform, has started promoting down payments of just 1% on homes in Arizona, a once hot market. If prices fall, owners with little equity in their homes may be among the first to default. Should the property market remain resilient, however, it is the Fed's policymakers who will face a test. Strong housing market activity contributes to an overheating economy. A sustained rebound in prices would also complicate the inflation outlook. The relationship is not entirely straightforward. Since property shows up in inflation indices in terms of rents rather than purchase prices. Moreover, the main inflation gauges tend to lag behind high-frequency measures of rents by at least 6 months. These measures have fallen for much of the past year, and the decline is just now filtering into official inflation indices, a process that will probably continue into early 2024. What happens after that is much less certain. On one hand, a record number of apartment units is currently under construction, and this supply ought to keep a lid on rents. On the other hand, the unaffordability of housing is forcing more would-be buyers into the rental market, which could push up rents and add to inflation. One big thing is clear. Until interest rates come back down, millions of Americans will have little choice but to defer their dream of home ownership. Section 3. High bond yields imperil America's financial stability. Talk of a Goldilocks situation belies real danger. Interrogating a fairy tale is not usually the best use of an investor's time, but there may be an exception. The internal logic of Goldilocks and the Three Bears and the idea of whether the economy can be just right for financial markets merits some inspection. Earlier this year, the prospect of a seemingly inevitable American recession, the result of rising interest rates, peppered conversations across the financial world. Now, with inflation falling rapidly, economic growth looking strong, and the Federal Reserve at least slowing the pace of interest rate rises, talk is of a Goldilocks situation, an economy that is neither too hot, with surging inflation, nor too cold, with unpleasantly high unemployment. As the picture has grown brighter, yields on American government bonds have ticked ever higher. The yield on 10-year treasuries is now 4.2%, up from 3.8% at the beginning of the year. Real yields, adjusted for inflation expectations, are at their highest since 2009. They are unlikely to return to Earth anytime soon. On top of buoyant growth figures, one closely followed estimate suggests that the American economy may be growing at nearly 6%, underlying supply and demand also point upwards. The government will run a budget deficit of around 6% of GDP this year, a figure that is expected to grow over the coming years. Meanwhile, the Fed has allowed around $765 billion of treasuries on its balance sheet to mature without replacement since last summer. Such good economic news has less rosy implications for the financial outlook than might be expected. Indeed, various markets are already being squeezed by rising yields in a manner that threatens financial stability. Sky-high bond yields mean considerable financial distress is baked in, even if it is not yet visible, and the threat is growing with every strong piece of economic data. Take commercial property. American office vacancy rates reached 16.4% in the middle of the year, according to Colliers, an estate agency, above the previous record set after the global financial crisis of 2007 to 2009. The combination of entrenched work-from-home habits and rising interest rates has been brutal for owners of commercial property. Capital Economics, a research firm, expects another 15% decline in prices by the end of 2024 and for the West Coast to be hit particularly hard. The situation faced by commercial property owners may deteriorate even if the economy further improves. 1 or 2 extra percentage points of growth will bring back few tenants, but the resulting increase in interest rates will put pressure on businesses unable to refinance the debt they accumulated at low rates in the COVID-19 pandemic. Newmark, a property services firm, identifies a maturity wall of $626 billion in troubled commercial property debt, where the senior debt of the borrower is worth 80% or more of the value of the property, that will come due between 2023 and 2025. Without a let-up in the bond market, plenty of companies will smash into the wall. Problems in commercial property could spread. Many American lenders have extended credit to the industry. In early August, Moody's downgraded 10 small and mid-sized institutions and placed several larger ones on watch for downgrades. Banks with under $10 billion in assets have exposure to commercial real estate worth 279% of their equity cushions, the rating agency noted, compared with 51% for those with over $250 billion. The problems that felled Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic Bank, and Signature Bank in March and April have not gone away either. Deposits across the industry have barely recovered since their tumble in the spring, up by 0.02% a week on average over the past 4 months, compared with 0.13% average weekly growth over the past 4 decades. The allure of the bond market, where high yields offer an alternative to low interest bank accounts, means the pressure is hardly letting up. For less leveraged firms, workers, and stock investors, the economic porridge seems to be at just the right temperature. Even in the residential property market, which provided the spark for the global financial crisis, owners have largely shrugged off the Fed's rapid interest rate increases. But the parts of the American market most vulnerable to rising refinancing costs are faced with an unappetizingly cold bowl of porridge. A Goldilocks outcome for some is a bearish nightmare for others. If Treasury yields stay high, it could become increasingly hard to keep the two realities separate. Section 4. India's surging food prices are a problem not just for India. Costly government action could raise prices elsewhere. To taste the effects of inflation in India, visit a fast food restaurant. Sandwiches at Subway no longer come with a free cheese slice. Burgers at McDonald's and Burger King are tomato-free. Restaurants are scrimping because of soaring food costs. Local eateries are hiking up the prices of tomato-based dishes, a staple across the country. In July, vegetable prices increased by 73% year-on-year. Tomato prices at some wholesale markets have surged by 1,400% over the past 3 months. All told, the annual food inflation rate jumped to 11.5% in July, the highest in more than 3 years, pushing overall inflation to a 15-month high of 7.4%. Food prices have surged largely because of erratic weather. Heavy rains in many parts of the country have submerged farmland and disrupted supply chains. Elsewhere, heat has withered crops. At the end of July, farmers across India had sown 40% less than they normally would have done by that point in the year. And now an exceptionally dry August threatens to hurt output further. Rainfall this month is set to be the lowest in more than a century. The Reserve Bank of India is holding its nerve for now. On August 10th, the central bank left interest rates unchanged for its third consecutive meeting since April. Shaktikanta Das, its governor, believes that the spike in food costs is temporary and expects prices to start falling from September. Some analysts disagree. Historically, vegetable prices have tended to increase during the monsoon months of June to September before falling back. But some economists believe that the current rise will last longer. The government is being more proactive than the central bank. On August 19th, it imposed a 40% tax on onion exports, hoping to increase domestic supply and push down prices. That announcement followed an export ban on some varieties of rice and a removal of import restrictions on tomatoes from neighboring Nepal. The food ministry is also releasing some of its grain stocks into the market to hold down prices. More subsidized tomatoes and onions are being offered to poor households. The government is expected to spend 1 trillion rupees, or $12 billion, all told, to rein in food prices. That is understandable. With important state elections coming up and a general election scheduled for next year, the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party knows that Indian voters won't put up with expensive food. According to a national survey published last week, perceptions of the central government's performance have fallen in recent months, partly because of inflation. Around 59% of people now believe it is doing a good job, down from 67% in January. India's policy responses may help contain the cost of living, but they could raise it elsewhere. Global rice prices have shot up since India restricted exports of the grain. That will hurt billions of people. About 80% of the world's population lives in countries that are net importers of food. But climate change is likely to make policies like India's more common. Section 5. Why Europe is a magnet for more Americans. The number seeking to escape violence and political strife in the United States is small, but growing. "What I envy you is your liberty," says Count Valentin de Bellegarde to Christopher Newman, the protagonist of Henry James' novel The American. Rich, self-made, and free of class prejudice, Newman moves to Paris for fun, only to be sucked into the intrigues of the French aristocracy. The template still describes one type of American expat, the well-off innocent who comes to Europe for amusement or edification. Another sort, however, comes not to enjoy the old world, but to escape the new one. "I didn't know what would happen to me in France," says James Baldwin, a black writer of his decision to emigrate in 1948, "but I knew what would happen to me in New York." More Americans are moving to Europe lately, and many are fleers rather than seekers. The statistics are messy. Governments have difficulty keeping tabs on foreign residents. But in some countries, the trend is clear. In 2013 to 2022, the number of Americans in the Netherlands increased from about 15,500 to 24,000. In Portugal, it tripled to almost 10,000, and in Spain, it rose from about 20,000 to nearly 34,000. In other places, such as France, Germany, and the Nordic countries, the number grew moderately or held steady. Britain thinks the number of resident Americans rose from 137,000 in 2013 to 166,000 in 2021, the latest estimate. Meanwhile, more and more Americans say they want out of their own country. Few of those who vowed to leave if Donald Trump were elected in 2016 actually did so. But Gallup, a pollster, found in 2018 that the share of Americans who said they would like to move permanently to another country had risen from 11% under Barack Obama to 16% under Mr. Trump. By 2022, it was 17%, Joe Biden's election notwithstanding. A survey by YouGov last year found that those considering emigration were mostly liberals. It is hardly surprising that conservatives are less likely to say they want to leave their country, and the follow-through rate remains tiny, a few tens of thousands of emigres out of a population of 330 million. But many recent expats say they left partly out of despair at where the United States is heading. "I do a phone call once a month with Americans asking me how to come over here," says Caroline Beringer, an American who moved in 2017. Miss Beringer, a former aide to Nancy Pelosi, the then leader of Democrats in the House of Representatives, left her job and joined her partner in Amsterdam after Mr. Trump's victory. For most expats, she says, politics was not so much the reason they left as a reason not to go back. Not just the election, but the continued divisiveness. The thing we hear all the time is that the work-life balance is so much better here, says Tracy Metz, who heads the John Adams Institute, an American-Dutch cultural venue. American workers toil for 1,811 hours per year, Europeans just 1,571. The well-rested Dutch put in a mere 1,427. The Netherlands once attracted Yanks looking to smoke marijuana or marry same-sex partners. Now the attractions are more mainstream, Ms. Metz says. The rise of international English makes things easier for Americans who are notoriously bad at languages. 28% of the bachelor's programs at Dutch universities are in English. Online job ads require English almost as frequently as they require Dutch. Some émigrés are drawn to Europe's robust social safety nets. Heather Caldwell Urquhart, a writer who moved to Lisbon in 2021, has taken a clerical job in Massachusetts simply to get health insurance. In Portugal, she and her family pay for coverage a fraction of what an equivalent American plan would cost. We didn't realize how shredded the United States social fabric was until we got here, she says. We felt the tension lift within weeks of leaving America, agrees Sylvia Johnson, a psychiatrist who moved to Lisbon in 2022. For Miss Johnson and her family, who are black, the central issues were racism and violence. She had been trying for years to convince her husband, Stanley, a lawyer, to move abroad. The strife after the murder of George Floyd in 2021 brought him around. He recalls saying, "I think we need to get a gun." When I said that out loud, I was like, if I have to live in a country where I need a gun to protect my family, then this is not the country for me. Stanley had a cross burned on his lawn while growing up in Virginia. Several of Sylvia's relatives were killed by guns. Now they are relaxing some of the wariness that black Americans develop for detecting prejudice and coping with police. While there is some racism in Portugal, they say they do not worry about violence. Other factors are more prosaic. The huge increase in remote working during the pandemic made living abroad more feasible, and the European countries that lure the most Americans have set up tempting deals for foreigners. The Netherlands let companies exempt 30% of skilled foreign workers' income from taxes. In Portugal, a residential visa requires income of just 150% of the national minimum wage, or about 1,100 euros or $1,190 per month. An easy hurdle for American retirees. Foreigners can pay a 10% flat tax on passive income, such as investments or a pension. Spain's Beckham Law offers a 24% flat tax for income earned in the country. Several countries are introducing digital nomad visas for tech freelancers. Such deals explain why these places are getting a lot of non-rich American expats. Other countries target the Christopher Newmans of the world. Italy aims to attract high net worth individuals by letting them pay 100,000 euros per year in income tax, regardless of how much they earn. France has a complicated exemption aimed at foreign business executives. Germany, though, has none. For all American expats' tales of political disillusionment, it is less important than practical matters. Everybody has convoluted how I ended up here stories, says Amanda Klikowski von Koppenfels of the University of Kent, an authority on the American diaspora. Many travel for education or work, fall in love, and settle down. Still, she says, there has been a change. Americans once felt that their country was the ultimate immigration nation. Leaving for anyone else seemed odd. Now they are aware that Europe has its advantages. Good health care, better transportation, less gun violence, there's racism, but it is a lot less deadly. To listen to the new American expats is to get a sense that the American has been partly upended. Americans are still richer than Europeans, but when they come to the continent, They no longer arrive as egalitarians in lands of aristocracy and prejudice. Instead, they admire Europe's universal healthcare, efficient public transportation, lower crime, and lower income inequality. In a way, they envy the Europeans' liberty. Section 6. How to get the most out of mentoring. The joys of corporate confidants. Gandalf from The Lord of the Rings, Yoda in Star Wars, or M from Ian Fleming's early James Bond novels all act as mentors, providing sage advice and guidance to the less worldly wise. In real life, as in fiction, the value of imparting wisdom gained through experience and age, Yoda is 900 years old, Gandalf is in his 1000s, is becoming ever more important. It is in a company's interest to keep its employees happy and loyal, even if the jobs market upheavals of the pandemic-induced Great Resignation are fizzling out. A good mentoring scheme can serve this purpose. Workplace mentoring has long been an informal affair, disguised as a chat by the coffee machine or a trip to a bar with a longer-serving and more senior colleague. Even the most successful find having a receptive ear a useful addition to the corporate armory. For over 30 years, Bill Gates has turned to another billionaire, Warren Buffett, for advice. Peter Thiel, another tech baron, credits René Girard, a French polymath and part-time philosopher, as one of his greatest inspirations. In recent years, businesses have sought to formalize an arrangement with the obvious rewards of nurturing a sense of connection and loyalty, and helping the transfer and development of skills. The aim is to support staff and boost their confidence by sharing knowledge and experience. At their best, when there is genuine rapport between mentor and mentored, such arrangements can help the latter to come up with new ideas and help them cope with problems. So how do firms build the best mentoring schemes? For them to work, some degree of chemistry is essential, as is a high regard for the person whose advice is being sought, irrespective of age gaps and backgrounds. Maurizio Orlaccio, a former manager of Four Seasons, a hotel chain, credited his career to his relationship with his mentor, an older executive who taught him how to motivate his employees and himself. Schemes should be self-managed, with the junior party taking the lead in arranging discussions, which are always confidential. It is best to let employees choose the person with whom they would most like to discuss their career trajectory, no matter their position on the corporate ladder. Requested mentors can be flattered but still decline. If you want to become a valued mentor, do not start by offering unsolicited advice. If you're being mentored, do not look for solutions to personal problems, failing romantic relationships, dandruff, or ask for bail money. But anything else work-related should be open for discussion. "I'm feeling wobbly, this is all too much to take in," is as legitimate as chatting about your long-term career prospects. Firms are increasingly recognizing the importance of FaceTime with helpful colleagues. Nicholas Bloom at Stanford University, using data from hundreds of organizations since the onset of the pandemic, found that the mentoring of recent hires was a key reason to bring employees into the workplace 2 or 3 days a week. David Solomon, CEO of Goldman Sachs, has echoed this in his push for a full return to the office. Despite Goldman's efforts, working from home has become a post-pandemic fixture, so virtual mentoring also still has a role. As with any online relationship, trust and rapport still take longer to build. No matter how clearly boundaries are set, there are inevitable glimpses of personal spaces when sessions take place on Zoom with cameras on. Bartleby recommends looking reasonably smart and refraining from getting a beer from the fridge. What seems natural when meeting face-to-face does not always translate well online. Reverse mentoring is also in fashion. Matching a junior employee with an executive whose understanding of diversity and other generational divides may need a refresher course could have benefits. There is room to debate how much a seasoned chief financial officer will learn from a millennial, But the best mentoring relationships are always a two-way street. Whether it is lunch, drinks, or a chat in the car park, mentoring's benefits are undeniable if it fosters a friendlier culture, staff retention, and development of talented employees. Think of Yoda's serene demeanor and galactic wisdom rather than his enigmatic speech patterns. The idea is to find, if not a Jedi Master, then at least someone to talk to whenever you feel stuck in your job. Sometimes, sharing a coffee can be just as powerful as wielding a lightsaber. Section 7. How to write a bestseller. No one knows, but a good guess is quickly, and don't stint on the full stops. Danielle Steele books deal with family, courage, loyalty, as the cover of one explains. They are also about wealth, fear, revenge, love, as the cover of another has it. Miss Steele herself has said she writes about stuff that happens to all of us, though arguably she focuses a little more on the sort of stuff that involves wealth, palazzos, emotions in capital letters, a little less on the sort of stuff that involves tax returns, cutting one's toenails, buying groceries. But that hardly matters. For her, books are also about selling staggering numbers of copies. Miss Steele has written over 200 books. The latest, Happiness, came out in August, and her next, second act, will be released in October. She's one of the world's best-selling living authors, according to some claims the best, and has sold over 1 billion copies. Her novels are a literary sediment, settling on the shelves of holiday cottages everywhere. She has created not merely books, but a brand. Everyone, whether or not they have read them, and most will claim not, knows what a Danielle Steele is, and so naturally the literary world ignores her. Publishing is an odd business. It is worth around $37 billion in Britain and America alone, but you would not know this from the literature that it produces, which focuses on books in the brainy vein rather than anything so vulgar as volumes that actually sell. One authoritative history of English literature contains 60-odd mentions of Shakespeare, 10 on the sublime, 8 on blank verse, but a blank silence for words such as business and turnover. In another literary history, popular novels, those jam tarts for the mind, as William Thackeray, a British novelist, called them, are mentioned, but with a wince, under the heading Problems of Popular Culture. When Gore Vidal wrote an article on bestsellers, it opened with the observation that, quote, shit has its own integrity, and became more dismissive from there. The book business, however, depends on those despised bestsellers. September is when publishers release the titles that they hope will be their money spinners, yet most books will be loss-making. To produce, print, and publicize a book costs about £12,000 to £15,000, or $15,000 to $19,000, says Mark Richards of Swift Press, an independent publisher. He reckons that it takes around 5,000 copies to break even. Most books never come close. Only 0.4% of titles sold in Britain last year sold more than that, according to Nielsen Book Data. Miss Steele's books, by contrast, have sold 268,000 in Britain this year. Jam tarts they might be, but people gobble them up. And yet publishers seem to have an almost total inability to predict which books will sell. As Marcus Dole, then the boss of Penguin Random House, a large publisher, said last year, success is random. Bestsellers are random. So that's why we are the Random House. Editors less sagely select winners than buy literary lottery tickets and hope for the best. Taking credit for a bestseller is, as Jonathan Karp, the chief executive of Simon & Schuster, has said, like taking credit for the weather. The word bestseller first appeared in the 1890s, with the first authoritative lists following soon after. Patterns emerged quickly. The writing can be good, H.G. Wells, an English writer, topped early lists, But it need not be. Just read The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown. Sex sells well, but celebrity sells best. Prince Harry's Spare, published in January, broke records for the fastest-selling nonfiction book. In 2018, a group of researchers from Northeastern University analyzed almost 8 years' worth of New York Times bestsellers and observed some general patterns. Bestsellers are very predictable, says Berkou Yosoy, the lead author. Aspiring writers should bear in mind that fiction sells better than non. Thrillers and romance sell best of all. Name recognition matters, so write lots. And if you must write nonfiction, which doesn't sell, make it biography, which does. Writers are often unable to explain their own success in helpful ways. In 1956, Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond, wrote an essay on how to write a successful book, in which he argued that there is only one recipe for a bestseller, and it is a very simple one. All bestsellers have one quality. You simply have to turn the page. This is true, but entirely dodges the question. Joe Nesbø, a Norwegian thriller writer, thinks good prose is like good food. You can't tell what the ingredients are necessarily, but you know it when you see it and you read it. Lionel Shriver, an American author, believes that if there were such a thing as just following the rules, then everyone would write a bestseller. No one sits down and is determined to craft a story that only 5 people will read. But make your way through recent New York Times bestsellers and trends become clearer. Of the top 10 bestsellers in one recent week, 3 were romances, 1 was a thriller, 4 were by a single author, Colleen Hoover, a romantic novelist whose first book, Slammed, was self-published, proving the unpredictability point. Only 1 of the 10, The Covenant of Water, is a literary sort of book. It has glum characters, too many similes, and a tendency to use words such as gloaming. The settings of bestsellers are often exotic. Fleming observed that the sun is always shining in my books. Miss Steele's books have titles such as 5 Days in Paris and Sunset in St. Tropez, rather than Fortnight in Glasgow. Their female characters tend to be called names like Lily and say things like, I only want you. Their male ones say things like, we've got rifles and grenades, they've got 50 cals. Accountants are not overrepresented in their pages. There are certain stylistic traits, too. Sentences tend to be short, really short, and repetitive, really repetitive. Think Hemingway. On holiday. Almost all bestsellers make the most of any research that they have done. A recent Danielle Steele opens with the heroine looking out over Rome at St. Peter's Basilica and Vatican City, the dome of the San Carlo al Corsa Basilica, and to the north, the Villa Medici and the Borghese Gardens. This is one way to run up a word count. The Da Vinci Code, similarly, offered such detailed tours through Paris that the overall effect was less like reading a book than switching on a slightly verbose sat-nav. But perhaps the most striking quality about best-selling authors is how prolific they are. James Patterson, an American thriller writer, has churned out more than 340 books, some in collaboration with other writers. Such speed, as Truman Capote once put it, is less writing than typing. Don't get it right, get it writ, is a common theme among best-selling authors. Miss Steele says that she writes until her nails bleed. Fleming recommended writing 2,000 words a day and not sullying this with too much introspection and self-criticism. The sentences in bestsellers might have benefited from a little more introspection, or at the very least, a second read. In one, a character finds her lover in bed with someone else and observes that the only thing that struck me was that his face was as expressionless as his buttocks, which stared at me from the bed. Reread that sentence several times and you may still feel it has not given up all of its secrets. However, if you really want to write a bestseller, then ignore Miss Steele and other novelists. because the book that sold the most copies in America in the past 10 years was by none of them. It was Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss. Number 3 was that other literary classic, The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Eric Carle. Children's books not only sell well, but they also keep selling year after year, building fans across generations. And incidentally, they obey the bestseller formula perfectly. Sentences of Hemingway-esque brevity, pleasant settings, and, of course, good weather. Or, as Eric Carle had it, one Sunday morning the warm sun came up and, pop, out of the book came a world-beating, best-selling marvel. Well, that's all the time I have for today, but thank you again for tuning in to Mind's Eye Radio. You've been listening to this week's edition of The Economist. This is Trevor, wishing you a good rest of your day.